Welcome back to another episode of Nui Tech People. Today we'll be sharing the best bits and nuggets of knowledge from the last 10 episodes. From episode 34, Cheryl Gledhill.
We sort of try to continue that. How do we encourage more females into technology? It's a very real problem.
Mm.
How can we, in your opinion and your experiences, how do you think we could help?
So there's so many pieces to this. There's one piece in particular that I have specifically been looking up with one of my startups, and that's at the job ad stage.
Yeah.
So language is really, really important. And a lot of ads written for technical roles, the people who are writing the ads don't realize there's a lot of bias in the way they write things. And actually, you know, the Guitar Center down the road?
Yeah.
Like 2 years ago, they put out an ad for a social media marketing person, and it was amazing. I was in this group of Newcastle women, and it was amazing watching their reaction to the ad, because they had a list of like 12 mandatory things that you needed to be the social media marketing manager. And at the end, they'd put like, oh, also would be good, the ability to shred a sick guitar. And I kind of read that and I was like, yeah, whatever. But women were reading it going, oh, they've asked for like these 12 mandatory things and I've got them, but I can't play guitar. Like I shouldn't apply. Or they'd be like, oh, I've only got 11 of the 12. So women read job ads really literally. And so you've got to really think about the things that you think are mandatory for the role. Are they actually mandatory or are they nice to have? Like, it would be great if you have three things that are mandatory, right? Like, language is so important. Or even like the way they talk about perks. Like, it's like, we do Friday afternoon ping pong and then beers. And that straight away says to me, you're probably a competitive environment where you've got a bunch of dudes playing ping pong. The fact that, you know, you do after work drinks on a Friday, as a mother, I can't participate in that. So I'm already knowing that I'll probably be alienated a little bit if I can't join in that. So it's about thinking about, how is this job ad going to read for somebody who reads things really literally and, you know, is probably not so confident? Like, a guy will read a job ad and it'll have like 12 mandatory things and they'll have one and they're like, yeah, I'm awesome for this job. I'm going to apply.
This is not the first time I've heard this.
Yeah. And it says language as well, like ninja. Never ask for a ninja. Never ask for a rock star. Never ask for like a gun. Like, just ask for what you need, you know? It's like, it's... people think it's giving personality to the job ad, but it's actually repelling a huge part of the population.
I couldn't agree more. And I couldn't agree more on the 12 dot points.
That's terrible.
12 dot points. I think let's, what are the core skills that you need for this role?
Mm.
Let's pick two or three of them. Yeah. And then most other things can be learned, right? If you get those core skills, right, and the right person, back to your point earlier about your experience at Blue Chili, what are your motivators? If you get those motivators right and those two, three core skills, the rest can be learned, and you'll find the right person. I think those other eight dot points, they just repel people, right?
Yeah,
and you repel them too early in the actual job process, mm-hmm. as opposed to...
And so they're not even getting into the funnel, right?
No.
They're not applying. It's correct. Only like the really kind of resilient women who are applying, and then you've got, you know, two applications from women and 500 from men.
Yeah, as opposed to three dot points, casting it wider. It's mm-hmm. going to take a little bit more work, yes, from the recruiters or the HR's perspective to go, hey, we're going to cast it a little bit wider by increasing two or three dot points and then actually have some conversations with people, with human beings, funny mm-hmm. enough.
Yep.
And once you have those conversations...
You can see how somebody will fit in.
Yeah, and whether it be for that role or another role, or you have a conversation with the hiring managers, the same when you're hiring a person. Companies looking for like replacements is, you know, it's never a great thing, because then you're trying to look for that exact person. Whereas if you treat the role, what are we trying to achieve out of this role?
Yep.
What are the core skills going to allow us to achieve that? And then look at it from that perspective, it's a completely different ballgame.
Mm. And it's like, where do we want them to be 6 months from now? Not where do we want them to come in at, but in six, because 6 months is a really long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the right person can upskill themselves so quickly.
If you had to say the second most important thing, if we look past the job ad and encouraging more females in technology, is it just that you mentioned of the boys club part before?
Yeah.
Is that changing at all, do you think, or no?
It's less obvious. So, you know, I've worked in all male teams for most of my career, and literally if I wanted to be part of the group, I would sometimes have to go to the strip club. And it's like, but I have to do it because I wanted to be one of the boys and fit in. And that, it's less obvious now. You know, it's still there. And I think as guys you know, I went to one of the Nui JavaScript meetups a little while ago, and it was funny. I was kind of one of the few females there. A dude came up to me and he's like, "Oh, you're a recruiter." And I was like, "Why would I be a recruiter? Just like, what if I was a Java? I'm not a JavaScript developer, but what if I was? You know what I mean?" It's like that right there. That's alienating. So I think, you know, not requiring women to have a really thick skin, that would be like the perfect world, right?
Yeah, 100%. And then also looking at mums as well, looking at mums and being like having some flexibility around work hours, and people have to pick up kids and some people do work best at night, right?
Mm-hmm.
Having more flexible work arrangements obviously helps attract a wider audience and a better market potentially.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I think, you know, once you have some immediate requirements around being in the office from 9 to 5, mm-hmm. you know, you potentially lose some of your best people.
Oh, you definitely
and
do.
A lot of those times mums can't do that, right?
They've
got children in school and daycare and other responsibilities, and yeah, more flexible work arrangements, I think.
Yeah, probably. That's a huge one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From episode 33, Siobhan Curran.
So our newish Vice Chancellor, Alex Zielinski, he's quite keen on seeing all students undertake work integrated learning, no matter what degree they're doing. And so that provides a huge opportunity for businesses locally to be able to engage with the university that way.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's perfect. And I2N is obviously a big part of that sort of innovation ecosystem we're trying to build here. I think we try to do our little part with the podcast here and more in the tech community, but tech community is obviously a part of that innovation ecosystem and the startup scene as well. So I think it's good just to see more players and somebody as big as the university investing so much in that ecosystem, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a huge talent pool, which are our students and our alumni, and you know, a vast majority of the students live within the Hunter region who attend the university. They're often first in family. They've come through enabling programs. They've got a real commitment to, you know, an affiliation with the University of Newcastle. And, you know, it's our job to not only, you know, equip them with the domain expertise that they get through studying their degree, but also providing them with opportunities to be able to develop those enterprise skills and those soft skills that are obviously useful if you want to start up your own company, but also within, you know, a knowledge base business.
Yeah,
you know, you need to understand how business works and what value you as an employee can add to that company by coming up with new ideas and new concepts and working in teams on problems that you don't have all the answers for in really short time frames, and being able to deliver it confidently as an option to your boss. You know, that is what employees love, right? Oh, yeah. So if we can help, the I2N can help develop out those enterprise skills for both what we call intrapreneurs, people within companies, and also entrepreneurs, people who are starting their own companies. That's exactly what we're setting out to do.
Yeah, there's a big opportunity there. Mm. And you mentioned before the growth, like obviously the growth with the big hub on Honeysuckle Drive.
Mm.
What sort of time frame do we have there? How big are we looking at for that?
So Hunter Street Hub, we've got 32 desks.
Yeah.
So we've got about 3 desks free at the moment. The new hub will have about 120 desks.
Wow.
So it's combined with the School of Creative Industries. So we've got 4 floors, and the way we've kind of designed the building is following the journey of an innovator or an entrepreneur. So the ground floor is very much open to the community. It's very much the what we call the first stage, which is all about exploration. So I've got an idea, but I don't really know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So we have an innovation concierge desk. So if you've got any questions about how you engage with the university, how do you engage with the programs, where do I need to go to get help?
Yeah.
That's where you go. There's desk space for people who are either working on our first stage programming, which we call Entrepreneurship 101, students that might be studying Bachelor of Innovation in Entrepreneurship or doing a double major, students, researchers that might be participating within On Prime, they can work from that ground floor at no cost. That's where we'll probably end up delivering a lot of our venture mentor service, mentoring meetings as well with entrepreneurs. There'll be a makerspace, so prototype development can happen, and a big event space as well. And we've got end-of-ride facilities because we're relying very much on, you know, active transportation to get in and out of the city along with the light rail line. And then the next level up is School of Creative Industries. So they've got an animation lab and a black box studio in that space, which hopefully our startups will be able to utilize too for stuff like developing their own marketing, like podcasts and green screen for their own, you know, marketing, digital marketing that they want to generate. And then the next floor up is teaching and learning space. So it's for us to be able to deliver our pre-accelerator and accelerator programming. So much more cohort-based programming, because we find that new businesses will survive longer if they have a team, a founding team, as opposed to a solo entrepreneur. And solo entrepreneurs can obviously work really well as sole proprietors and can work well in tech companies as well, but the research definitely suggests that they work much better and survive longer if they have a good solid interdisciplinary team working on the founding team. And then and then we have the top floor, which is the innovation hub proper. So that's where all of the co-working space, office space, meeting rooms, boardroom, big kitchen and sort of open plan meeting spaces will be contained. And so that will sort of be more for the accelerator teams, people participating within the accelerator program, as well as people who are then incubating after they've been through the accelerator program as well. So as long as they keep achieving their milestones that they're setting for their company, they can continue staying there until they get too big for the space and hopefully move somewhere locally around the corner or somewhere else within the city, so that we can kind of keep that innovation ecosystem growing and developing.
Oh, it makes sense as well. Hey, if you've had success going through that and there's more talent coming in, you'd be mad not to,
try to take advantage and there's this really good sort of culture of what they call entrepreneurship recycling. So even if you're not successful going through the pre-accelerator program, like you don't have product market fit, and that's good, right? Because you figure that out really early without spending a whole lot of money developing out
any time, effort,
the prototype or whatever, or the full-on product, and then launch it and then find no one likes it. So if you can figure that out, you're a really valuable mentor for people who are really at the beginning at E101 stage, you know, and being able to provide your expertise on the things that went wrong so that you can help. And we have a really good culture of that in Newcastle. And I think entrepreneurship ecosystems generally have a really good culture of people just wanting to give back and help, you know, the new people coming through so that they don't make the same mistakes. Yeah.
They're potentially also really good employees for other people. Like, not everybody's a number one, right? Not everybody's a founder. Somebody could be a great founding member but a part of a team, or somebody's a great number seven employee at a company.
Absolutely.
And hey, they might have gone through that, realized, hey, this is not for me, I tried it, it was a stressful experience, a bunch of time, effort, I still like that innovation, I still like a startup type feel or a high growth company type feel. Maybe I can join a company who's a couple of years in, who has got a bit of traction, and they're the perfect employees for that type of thing.
From episode 32, Pat Wheaton.
Healthcare, obviously a relatively traditional industry. You've mentioned you've been involved or been around some other health tech startups.
Yep.
Where do you see the change in your industry? Is it just continuation of more and more health tech startups? There's obviously a lot of traditional business that's not going to change overly quickly.
Yeah.
What's the change you've seen? Let's start with what's the change you've seen most over the last 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, very good question, James. So like health, I'd say the big trends, so, and it's across a lot of industry, like this increasing consumer, the consumer centricity, the sophistication of consumers, you know, heaven forbid, Google reviews for doctors and people demanding much more from their, you know, medical providers. So that's definitely been a big change that we're seeing. You know, historically, healthcare providers haven't really had to be, you know, operating in this sort of super competitive consumer-driven environment, and but now they certainly do. And you know, be it a public hospital, you know, private clinic, you're under scrutiny from the public, and rightly so. Like the consumer should have a big say in health. So I think that's one big piece. The other, and kind of connected, is that there's just much more competition. So either competition for funds, you know, if you're operating in the public sector, or competition from, you know, traditional competitors in a private setting. So people, operators of healthcare businesses are having to be much more considered in their strategy and you know, how they operate. And yeah, so the traditional kind of things of competitive forces are really in play in health.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the third one's, you know, the challenges of staffing these businesses. So ultimately healthcare is the ultimate people business, right?
Yeah.
So you know, you're operating for patients, you're operating for patients with people, you're often liaising, working for referrers. So you've got this real kind of complex people model, and, you know, businesses are finding it tough to attract and retain, you know, this as well as anyone, like the millennial workforce, you know, people, the expectation they're going to shift careers all the time. So it's really hard to find staff, and especially the really highly trained, you know, staff that these healthcare businesses need. You know, it's tough to find people. So, yeah, I summarise those as, you know, people, the staff, retaining talent, the competition, and then the kind of consumer focus. They're the big things that we're kind of seeing.
Yeah, nice. I'll definitely come back to that people part. what do you see going forward? More of the same, or is there anything else that's sort of coming down the pipe that you think is going to be a significant impact over the next couple of years?
Yeah, like there's a big trend, like the kind of value-based care is a bit of a buzzword. Yeah, and so the basis for value-based care is that, you know, the healthcare providers get paid for the outcomes that they deliver, and that might be in a public setting, readmission rates, but even on a smaller single clinic scale, like value-based care to me is, you know, around, do people value the outcome that you're delivering to them?
Yep.
And I guess it comes back to more that kind of, you know, that consumer-driven care. So, like, I think that's going to continue to be, you know, a real driving force, this whole concept of that you need to be delivering outcomes,
yep,
to succeed. That's either your payments will be linked to the outcomes that you deliver, or that consumers will, you know, ultimately their payments, the consumers will judge you on the outcomes that you deliver. So I think that's a big one. The other, like, and there's a lot of tech, a lot of hype around artificial intelligence, you know, particularly like my kind of core background was medical imaging, and I still do a lot of work in medical imaging. You know, AI, super, you know, overused, you know, and poorly understood change. And I think that AI, you know, it certainly has, you know, so much application within health, but, you know, how it fits, the regulatory considerations, all that's kind of a big consideration.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole heap of, and it, thing with health is that there's so many different markets within healthcare, right?
Yep.
So you're kind of seeing within aged care, you know, Royal Commission, you kind of think the Royal Commission at aged care, you know, it's about that kind of consumer, that increasing expectations from consumers, and again, rightly so, you know, medical imaging, GP, like there's a lot of sub kind of sectors within healthcare that are all facing their own, you know, emerging trends. But outcome, increased focus of outcomes. And that's ultimately what QVents is about, is helping healthcare organisations make sure they're focused on outcomes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so no surprise, I'm going to say that's one of the emerging things.
No, mate, hey, if you're tying your business in with, you know, where you see the future, obviously a very smart way of operating.
From episode 31, Nick and Matt.
And more recently, Matt and I have partnered up to do a, you know, cybersecurity services, basically. Yeah, and we're really excited about that. It's something I'm really into right now.
Yeah, we'll dig into that for sure. Mark, give us a quick overview. Who are you?
So very similar to Nick, actually. Left at the same University of New England.
Yeah.
Studied there, got my Bachelor of Computer Science with honours. Straight out of there, got a job at the university.
Yeah.
I was there for a bit longer than Nick. Was there for about 8 years.
Wow.
Java web applications, PHP, whole range of different technologies, Perl. Name I've probably written a web app in it. And then about 3 years ago, I moved down here to work for Boeing as well as a software engineer, doing a bit in the DevOps space as well.
Nice.
In my free time, just doing a bit of web development, Angular, PHP, Laravel, and then, running some pen tests on a few sites for a few clients.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah. So you guys met back at the university?
Yeah, very first day of uni, actually.
Oh, wow.
About 15-ish years ago.
That's like about 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I had a pretty good friendship since then. Yeah,
15 years, lads. 15 years, and you're still mates, and you've gone into business together. That's a decent crack, right?
So we kind of found that, you know, we've always worked full time jobs ever since we graduated.
Yeah,
but we found that we had a lot of sort of interest in doing other work outside of our full time jobs.
Yeah,
we always had a lot of passion for just learning new technologies, and you know, just trying to break free from some of the restrictions of the full time job. It gives you a bit more freedom. So we just thought it was a natural thing just to team up, I guess. Yeah, something. Yeah.
And then you've teamed up to create Pincone Web Cybersecurity.
Yeah, that's right. So we've kind of been doing a lot of web development for, you know, just kind of freelance style, just so anyone that just needs help getting a website developed or maintaining it, that type of thing. But it's really came about when we had somebody who had a website that needed, had some weird problems going on with it. So we did the investigation, found out it was actually a vulnerability that was just being exploited, basically. And so we offer a service now that allows us to, people pay us to penetration test the website. So we're effectively doing ethical hacking. We're testing the vulnerabilities of a website. And then we generate a really comprehensive report, you know, typically about 20 pages long.
Yeah.
And it contains sort of three sections. There's an executive summary in there. That's sort of the most valuable thing to the business owner. They can read that. It's really in layman's terms, lets them understand what it is that we've found that impacts their business. And then the other sections are more related to the technical details, and it's something that they can take to their development team and get them to fix the problems if it's, you know, cost effective for them. Alternatively, we can fix it as well.
Yeah. Right. So you do that, so you can do both the testing and then obviously help them out on the dev side and get and fix what's needed. So I guess it's a pretty nice one too, right there.
Yeah.
What sort of companies are your typical clients?
Just small businesses, mostly.
Yeah, they've mainly just been small businesses. So they've
startups.
Yeah, they're mostly startups, or some of them, you know, been around for a few years. They've all had some established web product.
Yeah.
Or actually, some of them they're just about to launch a web product that someone else has developed.
Yeah.
And they just need it. It's kind of the equivalent, I guess, like when you go to buy a house or if you own a house and you need a pest or building inspector to come and just an independent thing to let you know that, you know, what you've got.
Yeah. And just like a pest and building inspection, you sort of just see, you know, these are the things that are critical. You wouldn't buy this house unless this was fixed. These are things that, you know, you probably want to get looked at some point. Not a showstopper. Yeah. But,
and for those that have had their business website running for quite some time, you know, over time, vulnerabilities just creep in. It gets misconfigured. Technologies get old. They need to be updated. We let them know specifically what the vulnerabilities are there, and so they can get those things upgraded or patched. Or
whatever. Yeah, nice.
From episode 30, Luke Bennis.
Wind that back a little bit, like to you personally, you obviously come from a design background. Give us a quick overview of like your career, and then we'll talk about your co-founder and then how Brand Synth come together. But you personally, how'd that?
I just started out regular print branding graphic designer. So went to TAFE, out of there, worked at a local printer, Greg Tapp Printing. Great printer, and just was the in-house designer there and got to do lots of great work and did heaps every day. So that was a really good training ground. And then went to McDonald Jones Homes in the marketing department there. And then after that, sort of jumped out into the freelance sole trader Wild Wild West type scenario. But was working with Shannon at Crackler. So I was co-founder there for co-owner there a little bit for a while, and then but have worked with him and still do now. And then through that freelancing and working in co-work spaces a lot, which was really good, met Colin and Charles from Social Pinpoint. So that was early on too. So I've been with them from early on, essentially contracting to these people and then sole trader for years. And then over time, was doing graphic design and then taught myself web design. Was doing that for the last few years quite a bit. And through Social Pinpoint, because they're a SaaS product, started teaching myself product UI design, you know, jumped into that area of sort of design and coding a little bit. And so that's where I am now. That's what I really like doing the most and want to keep doing. And then so then obviously co-founding a SaaS product fits into that really well, because I can do a lot of the work that needs to be done there. So that's me, just regular graphic designer, sort of through web design into UI design and UX and whatever other words you want to throw around that. But yeah, the designer who codes is about where I'm at now.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And then you've partnered with a co-founder to get this product built.
Yep. Andrew Rutherford. Yep. Yeah. So he and I met about a year ago now. And just got on well and he had a pre-existing piece of work. Okay. And so I was, you know, beautiful Newcastle style co-working. So I'm in a co-work space with Liftango's coming in for a bit of space in our thing, and Andrew's working with them to do a bit of work. And I I work with Liftango for a bit of UI stuff. Andrew sees that and goes, yep, that look, you know, really good. That's, I like the way that you solve that problem. Do you want to come and help me with my product to tighten it up? And so we started working like that, and I learned what his product did. And then I sort of saw an opportunity there, and I said, well, I know what your product does on the back end, and here's what the design industry, or what I do as a designer, I think we can click these things together. So it's just that he could automate my job. That's what his software was doing. So I sort of clicked those ideas together, and then over time we decided to do that project together, and we have just come together to, you know, do this together. Yeah.
What's the timeline on this sort of product being built look like?
Well, he had some existing IP that he'd been working on. So he was about 3 years in then, and then we're a year now. So it's actually 4 years. But in terms of brand synth specifically, that vertical, not even a year yet, but coming up to about November will be a year, I believe. So pretty fast. Andrew's unbelievably fast, yeah. Very talented developer. It's just been, a lot of it's been around, like, you know, packaging the design part a little bit. Like, you know, he's the type of thing we're delivering, so we've got to get it really on point for that and make it understood. And then a lot of Andrew's learned a lot more about design than he probably ever wanted to in this as well, like color conversions and what a logo is and how I think about placing it in order to automate it. Which has been really great. Like, we have lots of discussions back and forth where I just tell him what I want to do, and then he throws maths at me, and we try and come up with a mutual understanding. It's been really great. Like, I've learned also a lot about that as well. So, we algorithmically place stuff based on, you know, some really predictable parameters, but it hasn't been easy to get to. But, yeah, turns out the area of a logo is much more important than its width or height. You know, even the aspect ratio is where we started, but it's all about the visual weight and the area of it, you know, how we use it and that sort of thing. So we've got a few interesting ideas that we've used to be able to do this in an algorithmic way, an automated way, because it's not easy. Like, design's been manual for a long time.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to push against that a little bit.
Yeah. Designers either hate you or love you.
Yeah, so far love. Yeah. So far it's a good thing, because, you know, the only thing that comes out of brand synth will be something that I would want to make.
Yeah,
that's, you know, as I look at it, that's what it's all about. It's definitely at the beginning safe, solid design. Safe being sort of a nice way to say simple.
Yeah.
But when you talk about getting a consistent brand across everything, that's exactly what you want. Like, you get your name on it. It looks like your stuff. It's consistent. And it's,
yeah.
On top of that, it's the right file format, you know, it's the right resolution, it's the right color space, all that stuff that you don't have to think about as well. So, the old file format stuff is taken care of as well. So.
It's been a challenge for a long, long time. I remember back in my marketing days, it was like, oh, do you have the file format in this? It's like, oh, there, I'll go digging for it and files and whatever else.
Totally, yeah. So what we've been able to do is separate the layout and design from that file type. So you do that layout and design once, and we can separate the file type. So I can give you a JPEG, PDF, code, that sort of thing. So that's a nice little element of the tool that we've got.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Mate, how important do you think it was for you coming from that design background? You know, you've went through the web design, but now into, you know, probably more into that technical side of it. How important was it for you to learn to code or learn the more technical aspects of software?
Very. Like, obviously people talk about should designers code, that sort of thing. And I think it's, if the designer wants to work in software, then 100% yes. And it's not, I've never made production code, right? But that's someone else's job. So it's not like you get a designer who can do both jobs. That's not what it's about. It's about crossing boundaries and understanding what's happening. I did design product design sort of statically in design programs, and then work with the developer to do so. I have done that for as well. But the translation issue and the distance between what you've made and what you get is really large. And also there's a few areas of this that I find really interesting. But as a business, if I put, you know, $1,000 in here to a designer to get this thing done, and then I put probably $1,000, $2,000 into the developer to get it made, but I lose a bunch of, let's call it fidelity or something, in the middle here, you're actually losing money out on the initial investment, because you don't get the thing sort of paid for out the other end. That's not the developer's fault at all, but just that as a business sense, it's a really inefficient troublesome process. But yeah, coding is super important. I actually find all the design tools really frustrating. The ones that are trying to help with UI design, because they're just trying to stop me from coding, whereas learning that more and more and more has just made me better and better and better. So I don't use any of them anymore. It's just everything is code. Yeah. Even though it's static, it's HTML, CSS, jQuery or JavaScript. Like, so any developer out there is like, yep, that's the basic baseline. But as a designer, it allows me to make things interactive, responsive, you know, scalable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that the differentiator is that you actually went to the lengths to learn that code, where there are, you know, there's that middle ground where there's a lot of people that just want, you know, want a tool that can sort of turn in X into, you know, Y. But
It's about expressing an idea, and like there is a there is a common language for it. And so some of those tools are just as hard to learn as HTML, CSS a little bit. So it's just about like, you need to express it, some sort of design idea, and actually the code is the best way to do it, because you want to hover and move and like have spacing and all those other things. So yeah, it's just super important. And the other really important thing is, like, although I don't write production code, say, Andrew and I have a shared master style sheet at least. So I am contributing to the actual product there day one. Like, I keep that tidy and I refine it. So there, like, you know, I do actually influence that, and the efficiency gain is massive.
Yeah.
So yeah, and even like more recently at Social Pinpoint, I created a beginning design system for them, which is just the set of design variables and parameters and objects in the interface that they have. But it's pretty simple, but it's very neat and tidy, and I made it in a way that's very accessible for the developers. But it's all in code. It's essentially a big set of code pens that I've gotten a nice way for them to get to. But because it's in code, all their designs now, they pull it out and make it perfect. So that translation's gone, because they know exactly where to get it. They literally copy and paste it. Yeah. So it's just like, and that, I'm talking about making a button and some headings and some inputs, you know, some forms, like box shadows, and just going, here's the box shadow we use. And just that brings consistency and high value. Yeah. And it's nothing. Like, there's no code there. It's just a style sheet, really. So
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super important. I can see, though, like, if you're a designer sitting here wanting to get to UI design, it's a big distance. But if you have been through web design a bit, then, you know, you've got some foundational stuff there. So I did do that. So it is a difficult road, but web design provides a nice path as well.
So if you're providing advice to a designer at the moment, they want to move down that route, you'd say go web design first?
Yeah, totally. Because it's also, that's a highly valuable skill as well. Like, product design is a bit further down the line in terms of being niche, but web design, like, so many opportunities for that. And even like, that's not saying code a website fully yourself. Like, and that's not even saying, like, you know, use a CMS like WordPress. You can go back another step and go, like, if a client uses Shopify or Squarespace, even you interacting in that environment and learning how it works is highly valuable. And for that client, you can do that. Like, just, you're both using Squarespace, but you come in as a designer and make an improvement. Highly valuable, and you'll learn heaps. And then over time, you'll move on to the next step. And 3 or 4 years down the line, you'll be making your own websites and be just as annoyed at WordPress as everyone else.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing, right? Once you teach yourself a little bit, you understand, oh, what you can change. You're like, oh, I know how to do this once. So I want to be able to do this and a little bit more, and you teach yourself that.
And that's,
continues to go down that route.
Yeah. And web design is beautiful like that. It's just really a set of 1,000 small tasks or 1,000 small things to learn, I saw it as. And because you just build and build and build, and by the time you're into 200, you feel like you know what you're doing, and the rest of it's just building on top.
Yeah. And it's a continual learning thing, right?
Yes.
As you said, you think you know what you're doing, or you think you feel like you know what you're doing, and then...
And then you look at it on Safari. But, yeah, like, there's things like that. That's just consistent. You know, then you get into the light browser compatibility. That's all the top level, like, or not top level. It's baseline, but it's stuff you got to get to and bring that baseline consistency for. Yeah. I mean, I taught myself, so this is how I see it. I just, you know, went in the deep end and redesigned my own website 5 or 6 times before trying to provide it to someone else. But even then, made things as good as I could.
Yeah, cool.
From episode 29, Jemima Urban.
You know, I think if I get to the end of a project and it's like, ta-da, here's the solution, and no one's seen it before, I've done it really badly. I think all of those stakeholders, the customers, the members, they need to be part of that all the way along. And yeah, we do co-design sessions where we can, where we get people to come in, whether business people or employees or customers, and get them to help us actually design the solution. So we want to use that expertise that all of those people have as much as possible, rather than me just being like, I think this is what the solution is, because that's not very human-centric.
No. Yeah. The human-centric is a big part, right? I think that's it. There's a rise in roles, not only in your type of role, but a rise in roles that sort of sit in between, you know, humans and technology. And it's about, you know, what are we building? Why are we building it? As opposed to just, oh, yeah, we think this is a great idea. Our customers will love that. And really centering it on your customer or those humans. Yeah.
And look, it makes good business sense as well. Like if you can test something with people before you invest a lot of time, effort and money into building the finished polished product, and you discover, like if you do that and you discover no one's using it, that's a huge waste. Whereas if you can test it early or do research early and even just a paper prototype in front of someone, and you can go, okay, well, that was a rubbish idea. Let's find a new one. And it just saves you so much in the long run. So I think it's so worth it.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
Do you think, well, I think bigger companies have already made that move to start to invest in these type of roles. Smaller companies, obviously, probably still in that space where you were at, you know, a few years ago where you multiple people or you're wearing multiple hats.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you see the future of your type of role? Just more growth?
Yeah, I think as long as there's technology that humans will use, I mean, I think I won't get into like the bot revolution, but I think, yeah, when, as long as there's humans using technology, there's going to be that need for people taking a human-centered approach, be that designers, you know, with a capital D, or, you know, just anyone taking a design approach. I think that's really important. So, I mean, the idealist in me would like to imagine that anyone involved in creating technology will have some human centricity to them. I think that's a bit too idealistic, but it would be great to see, and I've seen this at NIB with some of the people I've worked with in DebD, like they are hugely human-centric and they take that approach, and sometimes we'll say things and I'll be like, oh, why didn't I think of that? And so I'm seeing that change already happening with a lot of people I've worked with. So I think in the future, I think I'd like to see more of that. It doesn't have to necessarily be someone who's been trained or has a degree in it, but just making sure that whatever we do is embedded in human needs and it's answering a real human problem.
Yeah.
And if I wanted to be extra idealistic, to look at the impact that has on like broader culture and society and the ecosystem, like, you know, you make one, you know, that old story about like for the lack of a nail, a war was lost. Like if we do this one thing, it might be good for our business, it might be good for our customers, but what impact does that have on our community or our country or our society? And I think there's bigger impacts we need to start to be thinking about that I don't see happening enough now.
Yeah. Maybe a tad idealistic.
Yeah.
Just a tad.
Yeah. Some people are doing it. So I'm like, if more people start to do it.
I agree. It's a momentum thing as well. Once you know, more people start doing it and getting a further appreciation for it and see the benefits in it, it will continue to snowball, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Just looking at a broader system.
From episode 28, Nigel Castellino.
Senior engineer, right, growing into the CTO.
Yeah.
It's a big change. How's that changed for you individually?
Well, it's been very hard to let go of the coding and that and those kinds of bits. But over the last, say, few months, I've really, really focused on trying to get our processes right, focus a lot more on processes. So, things like, you know, how our product development process is, like our DevOps process, especially with the new product, like we're re-architecting our product from the ground up. So, you know, my focus has been on architecture. There's obviously been a little coding, but I'm slowly giving that away because we've got some great engineers and I really don't need to get into that space. But it's really about setting up processes so we're efficient, like our engineering teams and our platform teams are working very well together so that we can achieve our DevOps dream of we want to deliver high quality software every day, twice a day if we wanted to. That's really been my main focus, and that's going to be a huge part of my focus moving forward. So it's kind of moving away from, you know, the coding, which I obviously enjoy, but around people management, teams management, to achieve our
goal. I mean, we've got, you know, engineers in Vietnam, we've got platform teams in Sydney, we've got another engineering team in Newcastle as well that we've started to set up now. So, you know, making sure that our processes are so efficient that all the three teams can get together and again achieve that dream is it's challenging. Obviously, it has its challenges, but you know, it's worked well so far.
On that note, yeah. Mate, what's the biggest? So I'll put some context. Like, there's a lot of I think definitely in the startup space, but also in the SMB space where somebody's in a hands-on technical role and then grows into management. And then might you say a developer or another technical role that grows into that management. Now, what's the biggest challenge that you've had so far in undertaking that? Because I think that's a very real challenge for a lot of technical professionals.
Yeah, look, as I said, I think you have to look at yourself as an enabler. You know, you're not the one who should be doing the coding or any of that. You should obviously try to delegate more. Sometimes it's hard to, because as an engineer, you are too optimistic, right? You think that you can hit these deadlines and you know, you have to try and delegate things. So that's been a challenge, which, you know, obviously I've learned, and I think people who go through that journey learn about delegating, but also understanding people's personalities, you know, how they work. In our case, it's understanding culture as well, you know, how the Vietnam culture works with our Australian culture. So it's a lot of those, I guess, high-level management skills that you need to start to develop in order to, I guess, see the output that you really want to see.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Episode 27, Martin Carr.
So we need to develop a training system that allows them to have 4 to 6 trucks and go out in a virtual battle space and conduct a mission. So from there, we work out, okay, well, we need to build some truck cabins. So we talk to some local fabricators, Design Anthology.
Hello, Josh.
They do the hardware design, so we build a sort of mock-up of the vehicle cabin that will include a crew compartment for the driver and co-driver, a cupola, which the gunner sits in. So you can imagine big metal boxes. We put the driver and co-driver station on a motion platform so that when they're driving along, they get bumped and jostled around. It's not a, you know, you think motion platform, you think like big, massive flight sim, you know, huge thing in a warehouse. No, this thing's sort of only a little bit bigger than a, you know, regular vehicle cabin. We build a forward view array, which can be done with projectors or with, in our case, we use, or in this particular case, we use 64-inch curved monitors.
Like three of them.
Yeah. So the driver and co-driver share a, you know, a big sort of front view array, which gives them, you know, about the same field of view as I'd have in real life. The gunner in the back, obviously he can look in all directions. So he's got a head-mounted display that he wears integrated in with his helmet, with his communications equipment. He's got a replica machine gun that we put on a swiveling mount. So he can orientate machine gun in any direction. He can fire. You can operate a safety catch, things like that. And then, so that's the sort of physical hardware build. And then you've got sort of 5 of these vehicle cabins all together in one room. Then on the electronics side, driver, co-driver, gunner, they all are wearing a communications headset, straight USB device. They've got various other USB devices, you know, the machine gun, USB machine gun. You know, which runs off Arduinos.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sure, anyone who's in tech's familiar with simple little Arduinos that we hook up to the trigger and the safety catch and the swiveling mount. We use SteamVR lighthouse tracking for the gunner. So he has 6 degree of freedom movement, and that just runs through a plugin which communicates the position to the virtual environment. We use an off-the-shelf virtual environment, VBS3, which is made by Bohemia, my former employer. And then in there, we script the scenario. So we put all the vehicles down, we play some enemy. Yeah, it's all sort of drag and drop, WYSIWYG kind of mission creator.
Yeah.
If anyone's familiar with the Arma series of games, Arma and VBS3 have a common ancestor is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
So people that are familiar with realistic shooter games like Arma will be very familiar with VBS3. And yeah, we create a mission, and then we have a whole bunch of other applications that run in the background that handle communications, the mission recorder that records what's going on. So there's metal bending, there's API, C++ plugin development, DLL development, there's soldering, there's wiring things up, there's installing lighthouses, there's vinyl wrapping the vehicle so they've got a cool camouflage print, there's installing touchscreens. So yeah, it's a real wide range of different skills.
That's massive, mate.
Yeah, and then we build them and install them, and then we run them. So our guys will go down there and administer the system. Make sure it runs good and make sure any crashes are dealt with.
From episode 26, James Weekly.
If somebody wants to set out to be into a role like yours, senior data architect, right, looking around, obviously large sets of data, I'm starting to actually get some real insights into that. What's, if you had to say, what's some key sort of paths to that? You mentioned you did some training in around machine learning, or was a course in uni. Mm-hmm. Is there any, I guess, early job titles that they should be seeking?
Yeah, it's changed a bit, I think, in the last few years, and data science is now kind of considered its own course.
Mm-hmm.
I did it as one subject, kind of buried in between software development courses, but I think data science now, they'll teach a lot more of the math, the statistics courses that you need to really make robust kind of analysis.
Yeah.
It's very easy to, particularly when you're dealing with predictive modeling, to misunderstand what the data is telling you. So I think it's important to not just learn to code and then cross over straight away. I think it's important to do a little bit of basic kind of statistics. But I think if you do any of the kind of online data science courses or through a university, then they'll probably tend to give you a healthy mix of that. And I think the other thing that's important is that you kind of pick up on the job is that domain knowledge. You really have to understand what the business is behind it.
Yeah.
You can't just look straight at the data and not consider, the real world behind it. And, it's one thing to make a prediction that's accurate. It's another thing to be able to make a change that can do something with that insight.
Yeah.
And often, I think that's where my current role is important at NIB, is you have to know how it's going to connect back to that day-to-day process.
Yeah.
From episode 25, Robert Lang.
Out of, what's kind of the university degree? How was that university degree at Newcastle? How did you find that?
Yeah, no, I thought it was good. It had everything I need. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship from BHP in my first year that paid not only for my tuition, but also every summer I had a guaranteed job working at BHP. And I was lucky enough to be kind of ahead of the curve because I was sat down with experienced programmers who were teaching me to program industrially before I was learning the subjects in university. So that was really helpful. And a really good start, I think, to a career, being able to hook into industry early.
Perfect. And, mate, on that topic, because I think that's, I guess it's something that's happening a little bit more commonly now, and it's probably it sounds like a lot of people's opinion that it is the future, or is that mix of, pure education or formal education and practical experience. You obviously sound like you had a positive experience doing that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, early on I learned how important it was to be industry relevant and to be linked to industry. When we jumped to where did I go after my PhD, it really headed me back into industry because I felt like it was more interesting to be doing real things, where your software or hardware or whatever you're building is actually being used somewhere. Yeah, versus, not that I'm speaking bad about research, but for me personally, research was always, let's think up a crazy idea, and it may or may not have some relevance. It might be very, technically smart, and it might be very hard for some people to comprehend, but it also might have no practical use in the universe. So I was more torn to, wow, I'm building, you know, talking about my smarts days, when I walked into a room in a stock exchange in India, and there was 30 terminals all running smart software with people actively sitting there surveilling the market, that was cool. You know, that was like, whoa, our software is really doing stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we're not just building this stuff to you know, earn a wage. There's actually real stuff happening.
No, I mean, I completely agree. I think it probably accelerated your learning as well, right? Seeing how you, what you're building and how's it actually working in the real world.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Yeah.
Is that, if I had to ask your thoughts on the future of education then, would you think, you've obviously done your PhD as well, thoughts on future of education? Do you think it'll continue to go, you know, more of that mix between industry and pure learning, or hey, what's your thoughts on what you think would be beneficial?
It's a bit of a two-pronged thought process, I think, because I think that, you know, if you're just talking about the future of education, I think we can all see that self-learning, you know, is becoming more and more prevalent. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you can think of any topic, go online, and, you know, there's masterclasses. There's literally a site called Masterclass, which I've subscribed to, where you have things like, you know, Gordon Ramsay teaching cooking.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like a whole course of that. And
yeah, access to information is becoming, you know, just so prevalent. And the actual best people in the world teaching this information.
Yeah, the proper experts, like the real people, Steven Spielberg teaching how to be a director, you know, things like that, right? So the access to, so I think the future of learning is that sort of self-guided but still expert learning. But that said, I still personally, and that may well be my experience and my age, just see the link to industry to be just so beneficial to anyone's education. The more that you can apply it to the real world, the more that you can be applying it in an industrial, you know, or commercial application, I think that, as you said before, that accelerates your learning. It certainly seats your learning. It makes you understand, oh, I'm not just learning numbers and equations, I'm actually learning what they're for. I'm actually applying them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it says, like, the practical experience served you better going back into the education as well. So it was a two-pronged, I guess, benefits, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Newey Tech People. Let us know what you've learned or your favorite bits by interacting with us on social media. It's great for us to hear what's resonated with our listeners and what you've been enjoying. So please keep it coming. Also, if you haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast by hitting that purple button on iTunes. And if you'd like to leave a review, we'd be very, very appreciative of that. Helps us grow our little independent podcast. Thanks again for your support. Until next time, see ya.